Well, hello again, everybody out there in Turdville. This is your pal, Turd. It is Thursday, and you know what that means. It's time for another one of our award-winning, I always say that, Catherine, I just kind of find it funny, or award-winning by me. I hand out the awards, and so therefore this is award-winning. TFMR podcast series, we call it Access to Access, where you get to interact and ask the questions of the guest. And today's guest is Catherine Austin Fitz, someone that a lot of folks are familiar with. Frankly, I hadn't had a chance to visit before, so this has been fun for me as well to get to know Catherine. She's got quite an amazing and interesting background. She's currently the president of Solari Investment Advisory Services, but she's also the publisher of the Solari Report, which is something that you can subscribe to and have access to. She does a tremendous job there. And she's been involved in the federal government. She's worked on Wall Street for 11 years, and it provides quite an interesting perspective for her reports. And it's a pleasure to have her here at TFMR. So, Catherine, without any further ado, I just want to welcome you and thank you for taking some time to join us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Hey, before we get started, you were telling me a little bit about your background and how you came to your position and your worldview. For folks that don't know about you and who you are and what you do, could you just kind of take a second and just kind of put it in your own words?
Sure. I was on Wall Street for 11 years and working as an investment banker, and then went into the first Bush administration to be Assistant Secretary of Housing and ran smack into the mortgage fraud and left faster than expected. I had a ornery tendency to refuse to break the law, so I left early and started an investment bank. I discovered the internet when I was in the at Federal Housing Administration, and I realized, oh, we can use this wonderful technology to so increase the learning metabolisms in our communities that we can essentially explode the amount of wealth and get government money and government rules out of communities. You know, if you look at America bottom up, it's 3,100 counties, and most of the control occurs through controlling the federal budget bottom up, one county at a time. So yeah, my thought was, okay, entrepreneurs take this wonderful technology, we dramatically explode wealth, we get government money and government rules out of our local areas. Anyway, so I started an investment bank that was very successful, and then I ran smack into the fact that entrepreneurs basically re-engineering the money locally ran smack into people who were looking to control those economies top down. And I ended up in a food fight with the federal government. I always say, have you seen Enemy of the State? I played Will Smith in real life. And I spent 11 years litigating with the federal government, or sort of cleaning up that situation. And in the process, I had to dig in and really understand. You know, I tried to warn investors all over the world. I was speaking in Asia and Europe and the United States. I tried to warn them about the mortgage fraud, and literally no one would listen, or almost no one would listen. Had absolutely no impact on the markets. And then, of course, when everything crashed, everyone said, well, why did no one tell us? Well, the former Assistant Secretary of Housing was running around the world telling you.
So
in the process of doing that, I really got quite an education on how the financial system really works and how the top-down control system is really engineered. And I ended up doing lots of radio shows and talk, and as a result, people started coming to me and saying, well, could you help me protect my money? And I kept saying, I'm not an investment advisor.
Right.
This went on for years, and finally I realized, oh, I guess I am an investment advisor. So I started working with just a handful of families and individuals to try and help them sort of protect their money from the fraud. And then I would get so many of the same questions every week that I decided to start the Solari Report just so that I answered the question once a week instead of, you know, many times.
Yeah.
And that became the Solari Report, and it grew and grew and grew, and now it's a primary business for me. So my business is really, it's funny, I was just in a great conference down in Texas, and somebody was talking about the the Salieri report and what we did, and I said we're trying to improve the balance of power between the lunatics and the adults in the favor of the adults. So I'm much more, if you come to the Salieri report, I'm much more about trying to have a free and inspired life, of which part is your money. But if you look at the invasiveness of the control we're dealing with, you know, this is a whole balance sheet issue. It's your health, it's your finances, it's everything. So how can you navigate this environment and have a free and inspired life despite the all the shenanigans that are going on?
Yeah. I guess it leads me to that. I'm sitting here thinking that the first question I want to ask you is, you know, a lot of folks have asked me, we just celebrated our fifth anniversary here yesterday. And a question that I...
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. If you had told me 5 years ago, I'd still be doing this. I'm not sure I'd have believed you. But I get asked a lot, you know, what's the number one thing that surprised you? What's the number one thing, you know, that you've learned perhaps over these 5 years? And I guess my biggest surprise is that the ability of the powers that be to hold on to their power and perpetuate the system. Because you go back to 2009, 2010, you know, it was very easy. It was very easy for me to think, well, we're never going to make it to 2010. You know, these banks are zombies. The economy is kind of a zombie economy as well. But sure as heck, we made it to 11. We made it to 2012, and they kind of keep spinning and moping, as we call it, their way through, trying to convince everyone that we have an actual viable system still. When I hear you talk, though, you know,
well, economically, but I think economically we do have a viable system.
And I guess that's what I wanted to ask. You know, I mean, you talk about the control from the top down.
Right.
We all, though, kind of can't help but think that eventually, though, that we are morphing into some new global system. And I want to ask you about that maybe eventually, too. But in terms of
system, right, we're definitely morphing into a new system. But the reality is, if you look at the current system, the current, you know, there's an official reality and then there's a reality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the official reality is becoming further and further from the reality. What I would say, during the 90s and early 2000s, we had a financial coup d'etat. And literally, we saw in the United States alone, forget Europe for a second, we saw $40 trillion moved out of, and that's my back of the envelope estimate, out of, you know, households, pension funds, federal government, and shifted into private hands and control. That's a fantastic amount of money. In fact, that's enough money if you put it in endowment. The dividends and interest would fund running a global government.
Yeah. How about that?
So, you know, we've had and a lot of that money has been reinvested in bringing new technology out of what I call the black budget, or sort of secret government projects. And Craig, if you look at that technology, it's enough to, you know, it's explosive in terms of the wealth creation potential. So I call it sort of going from an industrial economy, global 2.0, to global 3.0. And now the reality is, if you look at certain parts of the economy, they're being allowed to die. You know, they're being stripped and then allowed to die. And if you're in one of those sections, you know, it feels like everything's collapsing because your part of the economy is collapsing, or it's being collapsed.
Yeah.
So remember, you know, what we've been doing for 500 years, we've been in what I call the central banking warfare model, which is a term I got from the wonderful James Turk. But in the central banking warfare model, you basically print paper off your computer. You know, it's created out of thin air. And your military gets everybody to take it. And so really you need to be able to print more than your military costs you. But as long as you do, you're basically harvesting the system. And essentially the developed world has been harvesting the underdeveloped world. And now we're rebalancing the global economy. And the question is, okay, who's going to be who's going to get harvested? Because there's no doubt, you know, that the harvesting is going much deeper into the populations in the developed world than, you know, was the fact 30 years ago. But what you're doing as you do that is you're bringing up the developed worlds, and those worlds are creating massive amounts of wealth. So if you look at things from the, you know, I call the committee that runs the world, my nickname for them is Mr. Global. If you look at things from Mr. Global's point of view, the new technology and the global rebalancing of the economy is creating explosive new wealth. And you're using that to offset the, you know, the areas that you're bringing down. And I think if you listen to a lot of the people who talk about collapse, you know, they are vested or living in the parts of the economy that are being brought down. And so they feel, you know, when my world is collapsing, I feel like the whole world is collapsing.
Right.
But in fact, that's not true. There are parts of the economy that are going gangbusters.
Well, and I guess that dovetails into what my next question was, because one of the things I'd found in doing some research in prep for today was a link on the internet to, I guess, a presentation you'd given earlier this year that talked about this idea of global rebalancing. And you were, you were explaining that just now, it made me think of, in kind of a more simple sense, I often talk about the creditors of the current debt-based system striving to create maybe what will be a new system or a competing system in the years ahead. Is that along the lines of the global rebalance, what you're just talking about, or would it even be a competing system, or would it be something that would work in conjunction with the old system?
Well, the old system is slowly, you know, you're shifting assets for, when you bring up a computer system, you don't just shut down your old system and bring the new one up, ba-boom.
Right.
You run the two parallel for some period of time as you shift more and more from the old into the new. And finally, once you've got everything in the new and you're confident, then you shut down the old. You know, so think of, I divide the world between the industrial economy, which is global 2.0, and the networked economy, global 3.0. And what you're watching is assets moved out of global 2.0. And part of that is a decision to run things much more through corporations. So you're watching governments get stripped of assets, and those are shifted over into private corporations. In fact, it's one of the biggest subsidies going on today, because you take an asset that in government is worth a dollar and you shift it over to a private company for 10 cents, and then the company, you know, suddenly has lots of profits because basically you've just given them a subsidy. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So they're shifting. Part of this is a re-engineering. So this is re-engineering, not through political means, it's the just do it method. And you're shifting, you're pulling money out of government and shifting it over into private hands where it is can be managed in a much more non-disclosed basis.
Okay. Now, I've gotten, like I said, we like to, the purpose of these programs is to let subscribers either email in questions or participate live. And I've got a number of questions stacking up in queue, so I probably better get to my email questions. And one of them kind of dovetails what we're talking about.
Okay.
It was about your relationship with GATA, because you had been on the board of directors maybe at GATA, or at least you worked with Chris and Bill.
Uh-huh.
And,
right.
But this has impacted your view of your expectations for gold, or your view of the gold market. And you'd mentioned when we were discussing things before we got started about how that impacted your relationship with GATA. And that was what one of the questions was what happened with your relationship with GATA? So do you want to expand upon that and just about what you think and how your views of gold and the gold market have changed?
Well, I think the guys at GATA did a phenomenal job of really digging in and helping to bring transparency to some of the nuts and bolts of what was going on in the gold market. And then they reached a point in 2010 where they said, you know, we want to move more to an industry-wide representation. And I thought that was the way it was going to go. And then Bill really decided he wanted to keep sort of lobbying about the suppression of the gold price and you know, do something very different. And meantime, I was becoming an investment advisor, and I believed that the gold price was going to peak and probably fall. And I just had a very different view of where things were going to go.
Sure.
In terms of where I thought the market and the price was going to go. And you know, and so really it became uncomfortable. So
okay.
Given, you know, I had a fiduciary obligation to clients and subscribers, and it was very important for me to just be saying what I believed was in fact the case. So my view of the economy and where things were going and where the gold price was going was very, very different. And so I, you know, it, the time came when it was just better for me to resign.
Go ahead, Kathy. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Please continue.
Right, but the, that left Bill free, Bill and Chris free to just continue to lobby. The other thing was that they, you know, one of the splits was they were aggressively promoting whistleblowers and certain programs that I just thought weren't credible and were really harming people, were misleading them. So, you know, and again, it came down to your vision of where you thought things were going.
Yeah, and that impact and what you think about gold price and the gold market, is that is kind of driven by how you see this, what we just talked about, just a bit about economies and the power in the current system kind of slowly maintaining.
Well, here's the thing. I couldn't care. What I care about is the health and happiness and well-being of my clients and subscribers.
Uh-huh.
So I'm looking at private families and I'm saying, how can I help that family be successful? And, you know, so I'm not vested in one asset class. I'm not vested in stocks or bonds or precious metals. You know, GATA's job was to promote gold.
Yeah.
But my job was to promote people. And so whatever is in the best interest of those people, that's what I'm going to do.
Sure.
I also believe that it is impossible in the financial or investment world to predict the future. So when anybody starts to promote a particular vision of the future as though it was certainty, you know, I don't believe in prophecy. I've seen, you know, I used to very much help people who'd been sort of stripped clean by the establishment before the bailouts. But since then, I work with a lot of people who've really been harmed by buying into a very specific, you know, picture of the future. And the reality is, you know, there's no one I know who knows exactly what's going to happen in the future. You know, just look at the recent fall in commodities. You're seeing tremendous number of insiders who've been surprised and really caught out and hung out to dry by it. People you think would, you know, have the inside track. So I'm not a great believer in organizing your life or your finances according to prophecy.
Yeah.
And so those two things have kind of put me sideways of a lot of people because I have a very different view of what the power and the abilities of the establishment are, you know, and people sometimes think, you know, that means I'm agreeing with the establishment or promoting the establishment. I'm not. I'm just trying to navigate reality as it is, not as I wish it to be.
Yeah, no, it's consistent with your personal opinion and realistic with what you've experienced. And so that's perfectly understandable. And I think it's valuable because
everybody
has their own experiences and you apply that and try to make some judgments as to how to impact things. And with all the people you work with, you've got to be honest with yourself, as you certainly are. My next email question, I only have one more. Well, it's actually two questions from the same person. So this one comes from Angela, who her first question is, she obviously thinks you're a very smart woman and wants to know, what news feed do you follow? Do you follow anybody specific on Twitter? Are there any blogs that you like to read? I mean, how do you kind of, where do you find your news? How do you stay up to date?
During the last 20 years, I've sort of developed a group of private individuals and researchers all around the world who send me stuff every day.
Yeah, perfect.
It's like my own intelligence network. So that's probably the most valuable source. Just as an investment advisor, it's very important for me to follow the official reality. And my three favorite sources to do that are the Financial Times, The Economist, and the Wall Street Journal. I'm subscribed to the Wall Street Journal. I also get Stratfor, which I find very useful. That's a subscription service around geopolitics and very much gives the official U.S. view. I find books to be enormously useful. So I spend a lot more time reading books on different topics. What I found is over a year's period, if you can read a serious book a week on something like drones or robotics or artificial intelligence, things that are going on, and completely ignore the daily news, you'll learn a lot more. What we try and do is I publish 4 wrap-ups a year, an annual wrap-up in January, and then quarterly wrap-ups where we look at the most important trends and stories of the quarter, but then each wrap-up we dive in and look at one theme very deeply. And it is designed so that my subscribers can read those 4 wrap-ups, look at no other news, no blogs, no Twitter feeds through the year, and be highly knowledgeable about what's going on. So I'm trying to give people a framework and an overview that with very little of their time, they can have a remarkable understanding of our world and what's going on is the goal. And then we do, right after we do the wrap-ups, we do an equity overview that does a sweep of the financial markets. We do a sweep of the financial markets once a week as well for people who want to stay closer to it. But my feeling is that, it's very, very important to get the right news. You know, you can lose and waste a huge amount of time getting the wrong news these days. So, right, and the hard thing is there's an official reality, and for all of us who are working in the real business world, we need to know the official reality, but then there's a very different reality, and you need to know that too, especially if you're managing money.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you know Chris Martinson at all of Peak Prosperity?
Yeah.
Going to say you're what you're talking about. It kind of similar to Chris. That's what was kind of coming to mind as you were talking about.
Yeah, Chris looks at the whole balance sheet.
Yes.
So
of life, really.
He's sort of a whole balance sheet, right? Real change. Our real power as individuals and real change comes from changing how we live our lives because it's our changes of our times and money and our saying, no, I'm not going to go along with that in my life where the real power is.
Yeah, agreed. All right, the second component of Angela's question is getting back to what we talked about earlier about the system and the kind of slow, dying, controlled death that you've talked about. That makes a lot of sense to Angela. It makes a lot of sense to a lot of folks. What are there any signals that would catch your eye that would make you think, well, maybe this is not quite as slow as I thought. This is actually speeding up a little bit.
I think that here's the most important $64,000 question, and that is, if you look at the energy technology which exists. Versus the, you know, we currently function on a fossil fuel model, which is very old. So we're very much functioning on legacy technology. If you look at the energy technology that exists, the day they bring that out of the lab and into integration in the real world, you're going to get very dramatic changes. And so the big $64,000 question that I watch and don't know the answer to is, when is that going to happen? I don't pretend to know, but when they do it, what you need to know is we have no debt problem whatsoever.
I guess, hold on. What do you mean by that, Catherine? I was thinking about the next question I ask you, but I want to get a little more detail on that.
If you look at the current wealth on planet Earth, it's less than 1% of what it could be if we integrated that technology.
I see. Okay.
So here's the thing: we did a quarterly wrap up called Planet Debt. I can send it to you if you're interested. And what I did was I looked at all the debt on the planet, but with a focus on sovereign debt. And if you look at the debt on planet Earth, it's really a control system. It's not a financial system as we think of it. The debt divides between two groups, somebody who can print the currency that the debt is denominated in. So if I'm the United States government, I can just print more. Mm-hmm. In other words, I don't have a debt problem. I can just print off my computer. It's like if you and I could pay our credit card bill with money we printed off our computer, we could run up our credit bill all day long, as long as people would take whatever we print off our computer. Which, you know, these days is now a military question. So the debt divides up between countries that can print the money you know, to pay off their debt. And essentially, they have no debt problem. Now, they may have a debasement problem, but they don't have a debt problem. Mm-hmm. And people who have to repay in something that they can't print.
Right.
So one of the reasons that the dollar is up so much since last summer, you know, it's up over 20% since last summer. The reason is you've got people all around the world who borrowed cheap dollars, and now as dollars are getting more expensive and commodity prices are down, a lot of them earn their revenues in commodity prices, there's a real squeeze on, you know, and it's just started.
Yes.
So it's basically a control game between the people who can print the money they're borrowing and the people who can't. And you need to look at it as such, because debt is the control mechanism that's really getting people to, you know, if you look at how the population in the United States is controlled, it's really controlled through debt. And part of that debt is not just the debt that, you know, a student has in their student loans, but it's the debt that's used to, you know, parse out lots of Social Security, disability, welfare, unemployment checks. I mean, if you look at the 3,100 counties, every county is basically controlled by more than 50% of the population getting directly or indirectly a federal check, all financed with debt, a lot of which the biggest buyers are our pension funds. So we're basically financing the system that is then used to control us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think, before I get to the listener questions, do these those countries that you were talking about that don't have the ability to print, the ones that are getting squeezed, the emerging markets, all the way up to those creditor nations that I talked about, be it Russia, China, India, do you think they have an interest, or do you think they even have the power to be able to not put up with it any longer, to establish something outside of the current system? Or does it have to be just something that, even if they do, it has to run parallel with the current system? Can they do something entirely different?
Well, what you're seeing is you're seeing the BRIC nations, so that's Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. So you're seeing the developing world basically trying asserting more independence. To do that, they need to build payment systems. They need to build global satellite systems. So they're trying to build those out. Now, frankly, I don't think is that competition with the U.S.? Yes, I don't really see it as being competition with Mr. Global, because I think Mr. Global wants to get to a global low-cost digital currency system, and this is all part of building out those systems. You know, and what I have seen is there's very tight global control. And within that, you know, it's like a corporation where you have different vice presidents competing. The U.S., Russia, United States, they're all both competing and cooperating at the same time. If you look at I just gave a speech down in Texas on the low orbital platform, which I think is right now one of the most important hardware infrastructures to really the game in the financial system. But if you look at Russia and China, they're both trying to build out their space programs very aggressively. And that's because so much of the financial operations are now working through the satellites, and it's becoming more and more important to control space weaponry to protect those operations. Sure. That's where it's all kind of moving. So I think there's a lot of both cooperation and competition between these players. You know, it's not either or, it's both.
Right, right. Well, I tell you, Catherine, that's really interesting. And we could sit here and I could talk to you all day. I find this really, you have some really interesting perspective and stuff that you know about. But we are about 25 minutes into it, so I better get to the listener questions, because I've got 7 or 8 that are piled up. And again, these might jump around a little bit. And if it's something that you want to expand upon, you can go for it. The first one comes from Infometron, who says, what is the big concern, or maybe do you have any big concerns about what's going on at CERN in France and, I guess, Switzerland?
You know, I've tried very hard to understand CERN, and I don't. The question is it just an investment in research and part of particle physics, or is it doing things that manage or manipulate essentially the electromagnetic field of the planet?
Yeah.
And we're publishing a Solari report this evening, which is going to be public, We do that a couple times a year, which is an interview with Dr. Joseph Farrell, where we talk about, you know, we kind of engage in what he would call high-octane speculation about what CERN might be. And if you're interested in that question, I would absolutely listen to that Solaria report when it goes up tonight. It'll be right on the homepage at Solaria.com. It's called WOW Secret Space Program 2015, and we talk about CERN and what it might be.
Okay. I'll grab that link when I see it tonight, and I'll put it on this page for everyone to listen
to.
Let's see, a follow-up question from InfoMetron would be, he says, what is the one thing, if you can narrow it down to one thing, that you think is absolutely the most important thing for the average person to know?
I think the single most important thing that the average person needs to know is that we are navigating a world where there's an official reality, which is completely different than reality. So they have to be, you know, we're basically in a state of enormous mind control, and that includes entrainment technology and all this crazy stuff. And that means you have to be responsible in every area that impacts your time and money to figure out what the reality is and use that to advantage yourself. And there's no more important area. As much as I love money and I'm an investment manager and and a financial person and money's my beat, I have to tell you the most important area right now is health, because the environmental pollution is unbelievable. We spent a lot of time at this Solaria report talking about what's going on, whether it's the food or the air, and how it affects you. We all have to take responsibility to do extraordinary things to make sure that we're healthy and our minds are clear and free.
Yeah.
Because that's going to make a tremendous difference. The place I see people lose money is their minds are not clear, they're not mentally coherent, and that's when they make mistakes.
Sure.
And that's when they get tricked. So I would say you've got to build a picture of how to keep yourself healthy in this environment. And when you do that, you have to understand that official reality is very, very different than reality. I just did a wonderful, to give you an example, because this breaks down into many, many different topics, we just did a Solaria report on healthcare advanced directives, which I'm a big deal, a big believer on. If you are unconscious and you head into the traditional medical establishment, you better make sure that there's somebody who cares about you and loves you, who's trained and planned and ready to protect you from the traditional healthcare establishment, which can be wonderful. My father was a very successful surgeon, and you know, the traditional, you know, God bless penicillin and antibiotics, the traditional healthcare system has wonderful, amazing things, but it's just become quite a dangerous place if you're not navigating it carefully.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's what I would say. You need to have a plan on how you stay absolutely clear, coherent, and on top of your game no matter what. And that means real attention to food and health in this environment.
Yeah, and really focusing on you as a, you know, an individual in a sense. We can get caught up in the grand
scheme. Well, here's the thing. Yeah, but it's I don't know if you've seen, Ty Bollinger just did a new series on the truth about cancer.
I have not. No.
You know, a remarkable series. But basically, if you really understand all the natural methods there are to heal cancer and sort of what the real deal is on cancer, and you know that before, you need to know that, it could make a tremendous difference in your life.
There's a guy that adds a lot of content to TFMR, goes by the name of Safety Dan. I'm sure Safety Dan's listening to this and nodding right along. Moving to give you the next question. This one comes from Matt. And it kind of goes along with what we were just talking about, actually. He said, with the vice-like control that the cabal has on the system and the general lack of awareness of the general public, I often feel helpless and defenseless to make any meaningful change, even just getting people to pay attention and wake up. What do you think an individual can do in the face of, he calls it, organized psychopathy? I don't know how you pronounce that. What can an individual do?
Well, there is a tremendous amount an individual can do. What I would say is, you know, our world is divided between the pro-centralization team and the pro-decentralization team. The psychopath that you're describing is the is mostly on the pro-centralization team. They get a lot of support in the population. And one of the things I've explored a lot on the Salieri Report is why so many people in the general population support them. You know, because it's not just the establishment. There is a lot of local support. What you need to do is, first of all, understand that, you know, put your own oxygen mask on first. So you need to clean the bad guys out of your life and your pocketbook. I have an article called Coming Clean, and you need to reorganize your time and money so it's working for you. And if you have time and money then to help out and go beyond that, you know, the first thing we can all do for everybody is stop making money by doing something that harms other people. So, but let's say you've come clean, you've got all the bad guys cleaned out of your balance sheet, your income statement, your expense statement. The next thing is, who do you know locally who's really getting something done? Do you have a great sheriff? Do you have a great mayor? Do you have somebody on the city council? Do you have somebody who's running the local SPCA? Find the high-performance people around you who are getting something real done in the real world locally and start to help them. And the more that every one of us does that, the difference it's going to be. Yeah. But you need to make sure you're helping people who are really making a concrete difference in the real world. Think very little. You know, don't think big. Think little.
Yeah. No, and understandable.
And what I see is I see unbelievably high performance people who are getting a huge amount done. You know, I'm very lucky. I live in a county where I've got a fabulous sheriff and a fabulous mayor. But, you know, you need to support the people locally who can really run things clean. And every one of us who withdraw our support from people who are running it dirty and give it to people who are running clean. We had a food fight about 5 years ago in my county over who the sheriff was. And what you saw was you saw all the high performance people just come out, and you know, it was it was war. It was amazing, and the good guys won. So it can happen, but you've got to pick out the people who really, you know, have it as their mission to make a difference in your local area, and you need to support them.
Yeah, that makes sense. I've got three or four questions left. One wants to get back to the gold question and how you look at it. Do you feel that, I mean, do you agree with, I guess we'll go back to the GATA premise that that there is a central bank inclination or desire to manage and suppress the gold price, you know, whether it's for a exchange rate or just as an expression of confidence in the system? I mean, do you go along with the idea that price is deliberately suppressed, or do you kind of more in the camp that it's just a reference toward a free market?
Well, I have a lot of agreement with the basic premise of GATA, in the sense that I think the central banks see their role as being part of a team of people, which I would include the intergenerational pools of capital and the insurance companies, who really see their job as managing the economy.
Yeah.
So I don't think they see their job as managing the gold price. I think they see their job as managing the economy, and the gold price is simply part of that.
Sure.
And gold plays a very, very central role. You know, gold is money. The reality is for the central banks, it's a core position, and it's very deeply part of managing the currency systems and the economy. So I see gold as being fundamental and very, very powerful and important, including to the central banks. That said, it's subservient to managing the whole global economy. And you know, I'm gonna take you a little bit off sides here and say the most important question when it comes to the management of gold is one I've never been able to answer. And it's the same with the debt, which is, are we managing in an open or closed system? So is the inventory and management of gold something that's just happening within this planet, or is it a multi-planetary system?
Do you want to expand on that a little more?
Well, it's tough to, because, you know, here's the question. We are clearly, you know, if you look at the United States, Russia, China, all these, you know, what you and I think of as the official governments of these countries, we're clearly dealing with what Richard Dolan calls breakaway civilizations. You know, so we're literally dealing with civilizations that have technology way beyond us. And, you know, the question is, who are they? Where are they coming from? If you look at what's going on in our skies, it's quite bizarre. And, you know, we're talking about trillions of dollars of technology and hardware very much beyond anything that we officially are dealing with. You know, if you look at the information that leaks out from whistleblowers, from the black budget, you know, clearly just our militaries have technology, which is hundreds of years in advance of what we're using today. So you have a very bizarre thing going on, which no one can really understand. There's so much disinformation, it's almost impossible to understand. I was just, the conference I was in Texas is the Secret Space Program Conference, and it's really a group of scholars and research getting together and trying to figure out whether technology or, you know, civilization dynamics, you know, who are the breakaways, you know, is it the remnants of the Nazis, is it humans, is it, you know, it's, you know, they're trying to figure out, but clearly, I think the big problem in figuring out what's going on in the financial system is you have financial dealings back and forth between these different groups, and the system we're looking at that you and I deal with is not a closed system, or there's a very good chance it's not a closed system. So I think the gold story gets into all these sort of rabbit hole questions, and we don't know what the answers are.
Yeah. Okay. And you had mentioned when we were talking offline earlier, I mean, you obviously you have tremendous connections and sources and friendships and acquaintances that you've met and developed trust with over the last couple of decades. And so when you reference these things that you're talking about, it, you know, it's not like you're just making this stuff up out of whole cloth. I mean, there's reasons why you believe these things.
Well, but here's the most important question. When you look at a financial system, is just a subset of the governance system.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I'm very reluctant to talk about, you know, when people say, how should we reform the financial system? Well, you can't talk about that unless you say, okay, well, what is the governance system and what is the governance system we want to have? It's obvious from the way the financial system is being managed that we're trying to build a global system, you know, and I'm always saying Mr. Global wants is a digital currency. You know, I think part of his fantasy is to have a digital currency that's very much backed up with his control of gold. So, you know, and that's why this issue of Bitcoin and how it dovetails with gold is critically, you know, is a very important question.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But that brings us to the question of, you know, who's Mr. Global? Who really governs?
Yeah.
Who's in control? And if you ask me to go to a blackboard and draw a picture of the governance structure on planet Earth, I couldn't do it. And I've tried. I've spent, you know, half my life trying to do it. So we all live on a planet where the governance system is an enigma, and the financial system is just a subset, and it's really used to control. It's a control, you know, we do not have a market system. We have a control system.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think, you know, one way you need to look at the financial system, and what I will tell you is, you know, in theory, if you look at where we are now and you ask how much longer can we control this very bizarre system, and I would tell you, as long as you can bring sufficient force to bear, you can keep it going forever.
I suppose that's true.
It's a military and enforcement question. It's not a financial question, because we're looking at a financial system which has sort of crossed the tipping point of being a controlled system, not a market system.
And that's another thing we often talk about here too. And before I ask you one more question, I just want to thank you being very generous with your time. And I know we got a late start, and so thank you very much. Can I ask you a few more questions before we begin
sure.
to wrap up? Are you okay?
Sure.
To that end, you're talking about the military end, and you know, we sense that and talk about that a lot here at TFMR. Andrew's question is, you know, what you think about the new Cold War, you know, and all the flare-ups that we see from Syria to Ukraine, you know, to now this talk about what's going on in Catalonia, you know, and Spain and Portugal. And do you see all of that? I mean, I would imagine you see all that as kind of being linked to the control part of the equation.
Well, remember when we made a decision in the 90s to rebalance the global economy, and what I always encourage my subscribers to do is to watch the video of Sir James Goldsmith. If you go to Solari and do a search for Sir James Goldsmith, he gave an interview to Charlie Rose in 1994 talking about why this was madness. And it's to this day, it's one of the best descriptions of what's going on in the global economy, because he really, you know, he really lays out what a tsunami we've unleashed. And of course, you know, there's no doubt with the Anglo-American alliance unleashing that tsunami, the question was, how do you maintain control? And at the time we started it, you had the U.S. really being the key military and enforcement bureaucracy that sort of, you know, ran the Bretton Woods system, and it's a flow control model. In other words, you know, you control the flow of the sea lanes, you control the flow of the satellites. By controlling the flow, you control and enforce the general economy. And there's a real conflict of interest between, you know, ensuring that you're financially the top dog and being the policeman of the model. And what you're watching is tremendous tension between the BRIC nations, because the United States, I would submit, decided to be a pig instead of being an honest cop. And so so you're watching tension build out in that system. But there's no doubt that the part of what's going on in the Middle East is the desire to continue to control the flow, because the more Asia rises, the more flow you have going back and forth in the Silk Road, not through the satellite lanes, not through the sea lanes. So the question is, how does the U.S. stay dominant? You're seeing the struggle of that go on. That's part of what's happening in the Middle East. I think the question is, what else is going on in the Middle East? And it's not 100% clear to me what else is. I don't know if you've seen the bombings of Syria, but you're talking about an extraordinary effort to destroy very serious underground bases. And I think the question is, who really has those bases and what are they doing there? So I think there's a deeper story that we don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think to this day we know why we went into Iraq the way we did. It's a longer story, but I know the Sunday before 9/11, I basically had got a sermon at church that, you know, and every month or so we'd get a sermon that was very politically, it was like I used to call it the facts back sermon, that basically said we're going to war in you know, seven countries in 5 years. I got the you know, we're going, and I remember calling on September 9th, 2001, calling a reporter in Washington and saying, did you hear we're going to war in Afghanistan? We're going to Iraq, and then, you know, we're going to Afghanistan first, then we're going to Iraq. I got the whole build out. So, you know, clearly we felt it was very important to go in, and to this day I've never, you know, I understand it's very important for national security purposes to control the oil price, but I don't think to this day we know why Cheney and that group lied to the extent they did to get in there. And maybe right. It was just so we dominate on the Silk Road, but I don't think we've ever gotten to the bottom of that story.
No, I hear you. You know, and you wonder, you know, and maybe this is too simplistic, but, you know, you hear all the stories about the Russian natural gas that flows into Europe through Ukraine, which makes Ukraine an interesting choke point, and that the Saudis and the Gulf states want to supply gas to Europe instead, and that has to flow through Syria.
The pipeline game is a very serious part of controlling on the Silk Road. There's no doubt about that.
And so it's interesting how it all continues to fit together. You stated it much more eloquently than I've been able to on this end, so thank you.
Here's the thing. The thing to remember about the gold price is it's simply part of the game of Monopoly.
Right.
And you need to see it as part of that game of Monopoly, and that's why, you know, understanding where the price is going to go in the short run is much more complex than it looks. It's not just a matter of, you know, oh, the contracts are, you know, 50 gazillion times more than the gold.
Well, I'm just, but what do you think of that, though? Because I look at it as, you know, this kind of modern alchemy, and that we tried to manage supply and demand and therefore price with physical metal all through the 50s and 60s. And it, you know, it got deleted when the U.S. is what we state as a stock, you know, in West Point and in Fort Knox is about half of what we had at the end of World War II because we were losing it so quickly. And then they came up with this idea that you can control supply and demand through this alchemy of the paper, of the derivatives instead. And I guess as long as the derivative system is still valid and legitimate, then we have this price. And that's just what leads me to wonder if, you know.
Here's the thing, because I love gold. So I'm a big fan of gold. But right now what I say is, you know, everybody needs gold as a core position. You know, and that's central bank insurance from the worst case. You know,
right.
Always want enough gold to bribe the border guards. And one of the things I love about gold is you can put it in your pocket and walk away.
Right.
Which is why the establishment hates it. It's anti-control. So, and that's why they want to control it. But here's the reality. You know, to me, the reason, the big, wonderful case for gold is the Asians, you know, the Chinese and the Indians don't trust the West for very good reason, and they're gold buyers. And I think as long as Asia's rising, which it will continue to do, that puts a huge retail demand for gold and silver, which is very strong and isn't going to go away.
Yeah.
At the same time, if you look at the technology game that's going on, we're facing a situation where if that line jumps by a large amount, and I don't know that it will, it's a big question mark. But if that line jumps, you know, you're going to see corporate productivity and place-based productivity skyrocket, you know, in ways that we can only imagine. At which point, you know, all those activities are going to be generating a lot more attractive returns than gold.
Yeah.
You know, because gold just sits in a vault and has costs. So, I would be very, very careful before assuming that the establishment loses control of this game. Because if they do, you know, we're in a whole different world. And I think the chances of that happening are reasonably small.
It gets back to what I was saying earlier about what I've learned about expecting, having them be able to maintain the system longer than I'd expected.
Well, I think they can maintain the system, you know, for a very long time.
Yeah.
So essentially, you know, to me, gold is a core position. And for your core position, you have, that's an insurance policy, and you don't care what the price of gold is. You know, that's your core position. You don't worry about the price.
Yeah.
As an investment right now, I think you need to be very careful because we could take another big leg down before this is over.
Understood.
And the reason I think the bull will reassert is because I think Asia will make sure it reasserts. But I don't underestimate the ability of these guys to create fiat gold to satisfy demand.
Right. I'm going to tell you, I'm going to steal a line from you. I wrote it down as you said it, because I get asked all the time how much gold should I have, percentage allocation, all that kind of stuff. And in the future, I'm going to throw out there enough gold to bribe the border guards. I like that. I wrote that down.
Right. So I have an article. If you go to Solari and do a search, it says I have an article called "What Percentage of My Assets Should I Hold in Precious Metals?"
Okay.
And I go deeply into how to look at, you know, while the price is still consolidating, this is how I try and get my clients and subscribers to look at the gold price. You know, but here's the reality: how many people are you responsible for? And how much do you want per person to bribe the border guards if things go sideways?
That's right.
And that's how much gold you have. It's not a percentage of your portfolio issue. It's how much insurance do you need for how many people?
I like it. Catherine, again, you've been extraordinarily generous with your time. And And though I could sit here and talk to you for another couple of hours, I don't want to inflict that upon you, but I'd love to have you back at some point. In the meantime, though, we always wrap up with what we call the final four, just kind of four quickies as we head out. You can usually answer with just one word or a sentence or something like that. And so if you're ready, I might just dive right in.
Okay, here we go.
Fair enough. You know, you talk about, you were telling me earlier, one of the things you like to do is drive around the U.S. Off the top of your head, do you have a favorite place that you always like to see or visit?
Oh, that's hard. I have so many. I love Western Montana.
Mm.
I love Kalispell and Whitefish and the mountains up there. So I have to say Western Montana is definitely one of them.
Do you go there in the wintertime? Or do you try to stay?
It's not too bad in the wintertime.
Okay, fair enough.
I spend a lot of time out in the San Francisco Bay Area, but it's become awfully crowded.
Yeah, that's for sure.
I love, obviously I live in Tennessee. I love Tennessee. I love the South. I love the Southern United States. I love the culture. I used to have a friend who was the head of the Confederacy Museum in Washington. And he used to say culture, and he'd say it with a deep Southern accent, which I can't mime. He said, culture is the integration of the divine in everyday life. And I love living in the South and living in the Southern culture, and I really enjoy that. I love Texas. I don't know if you've been to Austin, Texas lately, but the whole Austin area.
Fabulous.
I really enjoy it. I've been there twice in the last year, and I enjoy it tremendously.
Yeah, it's fabulous.
So I like the heartland. I like being around people. One of the reasons I love the oil and gas guys because they're so concrete and grounded. Well, you're in the heartland too.
Yeah.
So yeah. I love living. It's funny when San Francisco won the World Series. You know, they were out in Kansas, and for the last game, and all the commentators were saying, the people are so nice. They were sort of in heartland shock. They weren't used to being around people who were so thoughtful and kind and nice.
There is something to that, no doubt about it.
And I'll tell you, in terms of beauty, I love Idaho. Idaho is another state that I think is great. In fact, it was the last of 50 states that I ever went to. I'd been in all 49 except for Idaho, and then I across the border of Idaho. I don't know if you've had John Rubino on, but he's out there.
I've not had John, but I know who he is. Yeah, and it's out there.
Yeah, great, fabulous guy. He would make he's a great guy to talk to. You should absolutely get Rubino on.
I'll make sure I do that. I'll write that down, note to self. Second question, again, now this might be, this is a difficult one to answer quickly, but yeah, give it a stab. What do you think is going to happen with? I mean, it was 5 weeks away, and anything could happen in the next 5 weeks. But what do you think the FOMC decision is going to be in December?
I think they will probably bump interest rates a nominal amount. So max 25 basis points, could even be 12.5.
So,
figure 60% chance that they bump them. 40% chance they let it slide and do nothing.
Fair enough. All right. By a year from now, how are we going to do this for another year, Catherine? By a year from today, though, that we will have all of the elections behind us. Good heavens. My local TV news is already swamped with political ads, and we got a year to go. Who will be the candidates? Who will be the Republican and the Democrat candidates for president?
I think if you had to guess today, Clinton would be the Democrat and Rubio would be the Republican.
Okay, fair enough. And then finally,
let me just say one thing on this. It's very important for everybody to understand. If you look at the global, remember, if you read the Planet Debt wrap-up, it's very useful to understand this. We are creating a satellite and global cable infrastructure which can market to citizens all around the world one by one. So imagine 8 billion people have a smartphone. You've got satellites flying over them. You can interact with them with very powerful mind control entrainment technology, subliminal programming, one-on-one. Okay? And right now the global GNP of all women is bigger than the global GNP of China. And it is very much the U.S. sort of brand marketing strategy One of the reasons they're doing this huge women's thing is they are planning on literally through the smartphones tendering for all women globally on the theory that if women are aligned with the Anglo-American Alliance, you can checkmate and outcompete China. It's very much a global marketing brand strategy. And that's why you're seeing a whole world of billionaires absolutely adamant that Hillary Clinton has to be president, despite the fact that she would be an absolutely dreadful. Do you know what I mean? I can't think of the worst thing that could happen.
Yeah.
Right. It's kind of like, all the corruption of the 90s to an exponential 10, in a way that we all hate. Her negatives are off the charts, but these folks don't have another woman. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I understand.
And they believe it's right. It's pure numbers. They believe it's absolutely essential to, I call it, play the women's card. And traditionally, the women's cards have been brilliant at sort of rolling the local guys, whoever they are. So if you want to roll the local establishment, you pull out the women's card or the minority card, and that's how you roll the local guys. So that strategy has worked for them brilliantly for 200 years, and they see a way to pull it off globally with the smartphones. And what that means is if you're a U.S. citizen, you're going to have, the election is going to be a particularly revolting experience, and we may come down to, the whole country saying anybody but Hillary and the Republicans win as a result. Who knows what's going to happen?
Interesting.
But I think the Republican side will be Rubio.
A very interesting theory, though, and it's definitely in line with what you're talking about Mr. Global and maintenance of the current system,
right,
and the marketing plan of, and making that happen. All right, last one then is one I often ask. You and I are meeting for lunch today somewhere, and I hand you an envelope with 1,100 Federal Reserve notes in it, and you have to then go take that across the street and either buy 1 ounce of gold or about 70 ounces of silver. Which are you going to buy?
Gold.
That's what I always say, too. And you want to just expand on that real quick?
Because I think the chances of a big leg down are reasonably good, and so during that leg down, I'd rather own gold than silver.
Fair enough. Catherine, thank you again. Can you tell everyone, again in your own words, about the Solaria Report? There's a link here to your site, but tell them how they subscribe, how it works, and all that kind of stuff, because, boy, I can sure see the value of it.
Just come to Solaria.com, take a look. The interview we're posting tonight, we post every Thursday night. So the interview with Dr. Joseph Farrell will be free tonight, and that'll give you a taste. There's lots of other, we do a couple free interviews a year, so that can give you a taste. We had a great one last year with Steve Frosch on his book Unbalanced about the China and the rebalancing of the global economy. That's another great free one you can we have another great one with Richard Dolan that's free. Anyway, so get a taste of the free stuff. If you like it, just click on store and you can subscribe. It's $275 for the year. We have a special right now where you can get our silver coin or the third quarter wrap-up in exchange for doing an annual subscription, or it's $30 a month. And our subscribers are fabulous people. They're very talented, responsible people just trying to figure out what's going on in this world and navigate and make a difference. So it's a great group to be a part of.
I would imagine.
We'd love to have you as subscribers. So
I would imagine. I'll be definitely checking it out. I think you had a very valuable perspective that
anybody we interview is eligible for a complimentary, so I'm happy to send you one.
Tell me. Gosh darn it, I'll take it. Hey, that's one of the perks of the job, baby. I tell you what, I'll take that. That's awesome. Thank you, Catherine. Well, hey, and again, thank you so much for your time. We'll get this posted for subscribers later, but then I'll make it a public post tomorrow as well and send it out so that everyone can listen to it over the weekend. But thank you so much, and I'm really glad I've gotten a chance to get to know you, and I hope we can do this again sometime soon.
Okay, well, it's really been a pleasure, and thank you very much. This has been a great experience.
Thanks, Catherine. Hopefully the rest of your day goes well, and hopefully we'll visit again sometime, if not late this year, certainly in 2016.